Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jason Borger, and he'll be answering your most important questions on casting, mending, and presentation for difficult angling situations. The show's going to be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. Content of this broadcast is being copyrighted is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Jason about casting, mending, and presentation for difficult angling solutions. Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 1-307-237-5997. Again, that's 307-237-5997. Well, before we introduce Jason, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership for the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage and look for the link under Jason's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate, which can be redeemed for any merchandise at Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado, either in their shop or online at their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Now, here's how you win. You got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and it's going to pertain to something that happens during the show or about something we talk about. So you'll submit your answer via the front page in that text box that's there. Be sure to put in your name and your location. The person that responds first with the correct answer will win that $20 gift certificate. So be prepared to do that. We'll do that at the end of the show, and good luck to everyone on that. Well, our guest tonight is Jason Borger, and he's back by popular demand. If you haven't heard our previous interviews with Jason on casting and presentation strategies for trout and angling approaches for streams, be sure to check them out in our show archive. Jason published his first fly fishing article at age 13 and began working on fly fishing videos when he was 16. He later worked on the silver screen adaptation of A River Runs Through It, serving as one of the film's fly casting doubles. Remember the shadow caster? Well, Jason comes from a fishing family that's well known. His father, Gary Borger, is an icon in the fly fishing industry. Jason has carved out an impressive niche of his own. He regards himself as a fly fishing educator, and he is a consummate fly caster and instructor, as well as a widely published author. He serves on the Board of Governors for the FFF Fly Casting Instruction Certification Program, and he's also a longtime artist and illustrator. In his book, Jason Borger's Nature of Fly Casting, is a benchmark on the subject. He is also involved with education and research with the Fly Casting Institute in Montana. Jason, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me, Roger. It's my pleasure.
Well, we're glad to have you, Jason.
Folks, I'm glad to be here, too. I almost didn't make it.
I know. Yeah, Jason was just in Denver, and we were talking in Denver at the Fly Fishing Retailer Show. And he assured me he was going to get back in time back to Wisconsin, and I'm going to cut it close, and we did, but we're here, and that's what's important, right, Jason?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was at the Fly Fishing Retailer Show and saw you walking the show floor, talking to a few people, and assured you, yes, I would be back. I did make it by 15 minutes, so as long as I made it, right?
Yeah. Oh, man. That is cutting close. So if he sounds a little out of breath, folks, you'll know why, right?
Yeah, they're running from the airport.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we've got quite a few questions here, and also tonight, folks, Jason wanted to try to address questions that were overlooked, or not overlooked, but just questions we couldn't get to in his last two interviews. So we're going to try to incorporate some of those as well. Trying to stick around casting, mending, and presentation. But if there is something that comes up that you want to ask, just feel free to ask. And please do use that that text box on the front page to ask those questions. We really want to encourage that and look forward to your questions coming in. So send those questions in. We'll be ready for them. Okay. Jason, we wanted to talk about casting, mending, and presentation.
Yeah, small subjects. We should be able to easily get through all of that in 90 minutes.
Well, yeah, considering your book, Nature of Fly Casting, is what, 302 pages?
302 pages, and that was after cutting 100 pages out of it to bring it down to a manageable level. So, yeah, it's casting alone is probably 50 of these Ask About Fly Fishing interviews.
Yeah, exactly.
But we've got a bunch of good questions I see here tonight and some things I think that we can go through relatively quickly and hopefully get people some good answers as well as some questions from previous episodes like you mentioned. So I hope we can get to as many as possible tonight.
Okay, well, one of the first questions that came up was what casts, there's dozens that you have in your book, but what casts do you find most useful? Which ones do you use most often in your everyday fishing situations?
I'd say all of them. They're all most useful. Depends on the situation.
Right.
But, yeah, well, that's sort of the weasel answer. Yeah, they certainly are all useful at some time or another. Otherwise, I wouldn't have them in my repertoire. If a cast is never useful, then why practice it? Why try to use it? But really when you get down to it, for the type of fishing that I do, let's break it down just a little bit. For trout fishing, which is where I spend a lot of my time, particularly technical trout fishing, casts that produce slack in some way, shape, or form. And usually that means a cast coupled with a mend. And usually it's an aerial mend. So the line loop is on its way in the air, and then the line is mended before the line loop lands on the water surface. That's an aerial mend. So casts or cast and mend combinations that produce slack. And typically casts that have names like the puddle cast or the pile cast, reach mends both right and left, parachute casts, which would be actually a reaching of the rod upward when fishing downstream to produce slack line hanging from the rod tip, which can then be fed into the current by lowering the rod tip. Those types of casts and mend combos are the ones that I use the most and I find most useful, or combinations of them. So, for example, you're fishing up to a fish, a trout that's feeding right in the surface film. You want to create a cast that has a lot of slack, so I might use a puddle or pile cast, which typically is a cast that's aimed relatively high so that the line unrolls over the water surface, not down onto it, and then the rod tip is immediately dropped to the water surface, and that creates a series of S-curves all the way up the fly line. That's great because it creates almost an accordion effect between the tip of the fly rod and the fly. Great for defeating drag and micro-drag. Only problem is if you cast straight up to a fish, you put it right over their heads. So I might use a combination of that particular type of presentation with a reach mend. Again, this is an aerial mend. This is done as the line loop is unrolling in the air, okay, out in front of me. I then move the rod to the right or to the left. What that does is that takes the body or the bulk of the fly line and the leader and moves it over to the right or to the left, but the fly still is on target. Now, that's providing you don't jerk the fly rod over and yank the whole cast off a plane. I'm just talking gentle moves right or left and also utilizing that downward movement of the rod to create what we would call a reached puddle, one side or the other. So now I can produce a slackline cast or a slackline cast plus a mend that creates a nice drag reduction and at the same time doesn't fall over the fish's head. So for trout fishing, those are the types of casts and mends that I use the most.
Now, Jason, when you talked about two things happening in that cast, one to create the puddle or the S-curves and the other to make a left or right aerial mend.
Right.
Which are you doing those movements, the down and the left or right, at the same time? Is one happen before the other?
No, they are simultaneous. So, for example, if you were to make a standard overhead cast, aimed, in other words, your trajectory, okay, your aim point is in space above the fish, not down directly at the fish. We want the line loom to unroll over the water, not down onto the water. And then you reach your arm diagonally down and to the right, or diagonally down and to the left, basically reaching out away from your body to the right-hand side, or out away from your body to the left-hand side. That diagonal reach movement takes the rod tip, puts it down, and moves it out to the side simultaneously. If you can start doing those kind of things when you're fishing, you'd probably be amazed at what happens in terms of your response from the fish. You get a great amount of drag reduction, and you also don't line them. And those kind of things, of course, are covered in the book, and many other anglers have done videos and articles and books on those same types of cast plus mem combinations. And I really think that for trout fishing, at least, they're definitely key. If you're talking tarpon, what kind of cast do you use the most? Accurate ones that go a long ways, especially into the wind with a big honking fly hanging on the end.
Yeah.
You know, they're not necessarily talking using puddles, although in some situations with extremely flat water and you've got fish that are right up against the surface, I might use a cast that unrolls that big old fly out over the surface, not down onto it, and let the fly fall gently. Then I could begin to retrieve just underneath the surface and avoid potentially spooking a fish. But again, that's more of a specialized situation. Usually for that type of fishing, you're talking, you know, put it in the right spot, but oftentimes it has to be fairly long into a wind with a big fly. So finesse becomes less of an issue, and accuracy at distance becomes more of an issue.
Right. Well, I can see that, though, if you were back in the mangroves for maybe baby tarpon or something where it could be very flat water early in the morning or and no wind, then you would have a chance of spooking fish in that situation.
Yeah. So there we're talking still a very long and accurate cast, but perhaps one that doesn't slap the fly down, just lets the fly land gently onto the water's surface, and then you can begin your retrieve. But,
each
situation demands a different cast.
Right, right. Well, we kind of led into two of the next questions. I'm going to skip to the third one first.
Sure.
Do anything different when you're casting large flies like bass bugs or heavy saltwater patterns?
Well, duck. But if you can cast properly, you can avoid having to duck.
Warn your guide, right?
That's you don't want to get thrown out of the boat. That'd be the worst thing of all. Not catching a fish is bad, but having to swim back is much worse.
Yeah.
So anything different when catching large flies like bass bugs or heavy saltwater patterns? Well, being able to increase line speed to move the fly from one place to the other quickly without having gravity have its way and so forth can be one technique, particularly if you're on the salt flats, you've got to cast a long ways, and you have to do it quickly. I mean, you have to get the line moving. So, yeah, you're going to use things like either a single haul or a double haul, which directly speeds up the line by hauling or pulling on it. Okay, there's a little bit of rod load that we've seen in some of our studies added, but we see primarily a direct increase in line speed. Okay, so that makes that heavy fly move faster, and it gets to the target more quickly. It's less affected by the wind and so forth if it has less airtime and has better speed and direction. Sometimes, depending on what kind of heavy fly we're talking about, if it's back here in the Great Lakes and you're casting basically a wet sock with a split shot in the front of it, well, then I might actually use an elliptical cast, and that is a cast with a back cast made more sidearm and a forward cast made slightly more to the vertical. And that back cast is special as well. It's not just more sidearm. It's actually a slight sidearm swing to make the back cast so that the line loop creates what we call an under loop. It actually looks almost like a spay cast. It doesn't touch the water, but the line loop forms what looks like underneath the tip of the fly rod and lets that fly swing back easily, all right, and then swing up at the end of the stroke and then is easily pulled forward. You sling it to target. So in that kind of case, you're not using extraordinarily hard cast, although I would probably use a haul, at least on the forward cast. But there, you've got a little bit different type of situation going on. So you go from this very high velocity cast to one that allows you to move a lot of weight easily. Oftentimes, if the fly is particularly resistant to going through the air, it tends to flutter and twist a bit, I might open the loop slightly. You can cast tremendous distances with slightly more open loops if you've got good technique. You're not going to have trouble at typical ranges opening the loop up a foot or so. That's particularly if the fly is misbehaving a bit in the air. You don't want that thing tangling on the line. You know, you make a 90-foot cast, but the fly lands hooked on the leader, doesn't do you a whole lot of good. So, again, it's situation-dependent, but typically I like to make the flies get to target quickly, and I like to have them avoid my body if at all possible. So sometimes the elliptical cast is the way to go.
Well, that kind of leads into a question we have here from Captain Bob Jaspers in East Central Florida, who was our guest speaker on our last show.
Uh-huh.
It's nice of him to send in a question.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. Redfish, right? You had redfish?
Yeah, redfish.
Yeah, all right, I saw it.
And black drum, right. And of course, his question is about the kind of fishing he probably does on a regular basis. How do you deal with strong winds in casting the big fish in shallow, clear, open water? So I assume he's probably kind of referencing the likelihood that you're going to spook them with those kind of conditions.
Yeah, if you've got strong winds, at least you've got some chop. So from the perspective of the fish seeing out and so forth, you have at least somewhat of an advantage because the surface is so ruffled and the fish's window looking out is going to be a bit of a mess. But when dealing with strong winds, a haul does wonders. And learning how to utilize a haul properly, single or double, can really help with your presentation in strong winds. Now, I'm not talking necessarily using a double-handed rods here or something like that. That's a whole different subcategory, and some people are now doing that. So we're talking about single-handed rods. Using a haul and adjusting your trajectory. Oftentimes we think about long distance, you know, just aim that thing wherever and heave and let it go. But in strong wind, that could be a mistake because if you aim the cast high and the line unrolls high over the water surface, all of a sudden you just have a static line out there that can get blown all over the place. Your aim is off. It may blow the line down exactly where you don't want it to go. It may blow the line short so the fish never even sees the fly to begin with. So what we're talking about here is actually adjusting the backcast and forecast angles so that the fly unrolls just above the water surface. The trick is, of course, getting it to roll on the water surface and not getting it to unroll splashing down before it ever gets to the target. That requires a little bit of practice. But, yeah, adjusting trajectory, being able to increase your line speed. Hey, if the line and the fly are moving faster through the air, they have more energy, they're going to go farther. Even if it's a very strong wind and you can only cast 60 feet, hey, if you can add that haul, you may also be able to get better delivery and make the fly get the target more accurately. And some people actually like to add a little haul right at the very, very end of the cast. They may be shooting a little line into the wind, and right about at the point where the leader is going to unroll, you either just check the line by grabbing it or give the line a quick little sharp tug. Boom, that'll turn that fly line over like a shot, puts the fly right on target. That might be too much for fish that are in very shallow water. You might spook them with that kind of presentation. So I would say get your haul, get it figured out, learn how to use it because it can be a valuable tool, and then understand trajectory. And if you don't understand it, get out in the yard and practice it. That's the best way to figure things out sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit more about those hauls. So everybody stay tuned, and we'll be right back. Are you aware of the proposed Pebble Mine project in southwest Alaska? This enormous open pit could generate as much as 3 billion tons of waste in a seismic area with some of the most important trout and Pacific salmon fisheries in all of Alaska, or the world for that matter. The well-being of Lake Iliamna and the entire Bristol Bay Area waters may be at stake. If you have not already, acquaint yourself with the concerns. You can make a difference, and the ramifications reach far beyond fly fishing. Go to www.bristolbayalliance.com. That's www.bristolbayalliance.com to find out more about this potential catastrophe. Get involved, be proactive, help protect our environment and the future of fly fishing. If you know of other conservation issues, please bring them to our attention at info@askaboutflyfishing.com. We'll be discussing these types of issues in our new Ask About Fly Fishing blog, so we'll talk to you more about that as that becomes live. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jason Borger about casting, mending, and presentation for difficult angling situations. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage and submit your question in that text box. We'll get the questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay.
We've got quite a few here, don't we?
What?
We have quite a few here, I see.
I know, and I just got one live I was reading. That's why I was kind of pausing there for a second. Okay, let's we'll work this one that came in live here in a minute.
Sure.
Mending. But next question we have here is, I have problems casting a weighted two-fly rig. I get a lot of tangles. What do I need to do to change to accommodate a rig like this?
Actually, the elliptical casting stroke with the underloop I talked about earlier for slinging those the big nasties, there you go. That's your answer. That's, well, at least that's one answer, but that's one that I would definitely use. Keeps that stuff moving under what people sometimes refer to as constant tension, and it keeps it out away from your body.
So you're kind of getting away from that tight loop and kind of opening it up in a different way.
Opening it up in a slightly different way, allowing that two-fly rig to sort of swing up and back and around and forward versus trying to make two very distinct separate casts that are more traditional in nature. You know, you wouldn't necessarily want to use a size 18 dry fly cast with this kind of
rig. Right. I think that's what happens to folks when
it gets ugly.
They make a beautiful dry fly cast, and then they go to do the two-fly weighted rig, and they're all a mess. So.
Yeah.
Back to the single and double haul. Is there? Can you give an appropriate examples to use one or the other? You know, where one would be more appropriate than the other if you're only doing a single.
I think for most people, if you're going to learn a single first, probably learn on the forward cast. Typically. It's on the forward cast where we're trying to either drive for a bit more distance, we're trying to drive into a wind, we're trying to take a heavy fly or an air-resistant fly, not necessarily heavy, but it could be a big skater or something, and get that through the wind or just out through the air in general. I mean, skaters sometimes, it could be a nightmare to cast because they're very light, but they're large. So for most people, the single haul, if you're only going to learn one part of it, would be on the forward cast. That's what I would recommend. And any kind of situation where you've got wind, where you've got extra distance you need, and so forth, that haul can definitely assist you. Personally, I double haul on, it seems like, almost all of my casts, even a lot of my presentation casts, because I can use that to manipulate line speed. I can put a tiny amount of haul in there to change things a little bit. I can put a lot of haul in there to change things dramatically. So once you learn the double haul, it's something that you can utilize at all distances. It's not just for casting a long ways or casting giant flies. You know, you think about it. If you're adding line speed with your line hand, that means you can ease off with your rod hand. You don't have to add as much energy. So it actually becomes more relaxing. At least I find it does, and I think many other anglers do too, that once you get that double haul in place and you're doing it well, you'll use it for all sorts of situations, and you'll tune it to the situation. You'd be amazed what it can do for you. I think it's a very valuable technique. Even if you're just a guy fishing 30 feet on trout streams, you can make it do some interesting things for you, particularly if the conditions get difficult.
I'm wondering if, you know, you're on a trout stream with maybe a heavy canopy above and you need to get a lot of line speed to get distance, but you don't have a lot of vertical space to work in. Would that be an appropriate use?
It could be an appropriate use. I'd also recommend something like a switch cast, which is, many people would recognize it, in this country at least, as a very active roll cast. It would be the cast that is essentially the delivery cast for most of the spay and spay-related types of casts. It looks like a roll cast on steroids. Yeah, the line jumps back, touches the water only briefly, just the leader and a short piece of the fly line, and then it's cast forward. And you can cast that with a haul as well, even a double haul once you get really good at it. But that can really help you in those tight situations. And you don't even have to have really a back cast. I mean, you have a very limited back cast room, very limited overhead room, and you can combine that particular type of cast with the haul to put the fly out at amazing distances. In fact, a lot of times you could cast farther than you'd need to in many trout fishing situations.
Well, I noticed there at the fly fishing retailers show they were having the competitions, and I only had time to watch a little bit of the competition, but it is amazing to see some of these expert casters make a 100-foot cast with maybe only one or at most two false casts and with the double haul and out they are to 100 feet.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
The efficiency is tremendous. And a lot of times people say, well, I'm never going to cast that far. I don't fish in the salt. You know, I don't fish in big lakes. I'm never going to cast 100 feet. But you know what?
The skills that let you cast 100 feet, and I'm just going to quote my own book here, are very useful at half that distance. They really, truly are. And there are, once you begin to get a hold of some of these skills, I mean really get a hold of them, sometimes it requires a fair amount of practice. So once you've got them, you can do all sorts of very interesting things, literally, at half that distance, at 50 feet or even 30 feet, because it just gives you more ability to manipulate what's going on with the cast, and sometimes, more importantly, to manipulate what you're going to do with the mend and how you're going to place the fly. Now, like I say, you know, casting gets the fly to the fish, right? And in some cases, you know, in the salt, for instance, if you have to cast a long, long ways, that's most of it. You've got to get the fly out there, so you have to be a great distance caster. But, you know, sometimes in flowing waters, the cast gets the fly to the fish, but it's oftentimes the mending that's going to wind up catching them. So just having more and more and more in your bag of tricks will allow you to be better no matter what the situation.
Okay, next question. Jason, what and this is from Dennis Myers in Washington. Jason, what creates a cast to just die on the final last 5 to 7 feet of a 35-foot cast?
My guess is, and there could be a number of reasons for it, but typically the most obvious reason, not being able to see him cast over the phone, would be probably a doming pathway of the rod tip. What I mean is the rod tip's getting moved through a fairly significant arc that starts low, high in the middle, finishes low. And that causes, of course, the fly line and the leader to follow along. You start getting that type of motion going on, and the tippet and leader, almost without fail, will pile up. Line, usually the end of the line will pile a little bit, but the line's got a fair amount of mass. But as soon as that line, that leader and tippet come over, you know, they're fairly thin, they don't have a lot of mass. They encounter some wind resistance and so forth, and they just kind of pile up at the end. It drives people insane. So you might want to think about actually casting with more conservative motion. By conservative motion, I mean more controlled motion that is over a shorter distance. Oftentimes people put too much energy and too much motion, physical motion, back and forth into a cast, especially if it's only 35 feet or so. You'd be amazed once you really begin to focus on efficiency how simple it is to cast 35 feet. It's also pretty amazing when you're first starting out how hard it can be to cast. It's like learning how to drive. You know, the first time you go out, it seems like the steering wheel is never going to turn. And then after that, you've got control of it. So that is my guess as to what's happening. You might want to watch yourself in a mirror, actually. Just run through the casting stroke with the butt of the rod and just take a look what's happening with your arm. And if you've got a lot of excessive arcing motion, well, there may be a problem right there, and that could be your solution. You might want to talk to somebody at a shop or an instructor to have a look at you.
And then we have a question from Chuck Shaw in Chicago. And he's referring to your book here. I am having a problem with the foundation casting stroke. My transition from the back cast to the forward cast, instead of letting just gravity lower my elbow to begin the forward cast, I always put a little back drift into my casting stroke to help me with the timing of the beginning of the forward stroke and the dropping of my elbow. With the fly O, I have no problem with the foundation casting stroke. However, when I have a rod in my hand with line outside the tip, I always seem to want to put a little drift in to help me for the timing of the stroke. Any suggestions to eliminate my hitch?
Well, I would say one of the things that I actually do for people that are having trouble with their forward cast timing, and usually when we're talking about this type of thing, we're talking about something called creep, and that's a term that refers to this sort of inadvertent rotating of the fly rod forward while the line is unrolling behind you, and all of a sudden you're trying to start the forward cast with the rod tilted much more towards vertical. You run out of room, and you either push the rod forward and you get a tailing loop, or you slap the line down onto the water, that type of thing. And I think what Chuck is doing here actually is utilizing drift just a little bit, and drift meaning just moving his hand up and back in the direction of the back cast to help him make sure he doesn't creep forward, to make sure that the timing is right on and everything. I mean, that's fine. I actually, one of the things I do in my casting clinics is have people use what I call layback, which is a form of drift that also helps them eliminate creep and helps them get a sense for the timing. If you want to eliminate that just to have an incredibly pure, clean stroke, it may require some fairly significant practice and self-control just so that you're really watching what's going on with your hand. A mirror can do it. Video camera can do it. Literally just turning your head and watching the stroke can do it. Just holding that fly rod still as the line loop unrolls, and then come forward. Now, that may sound like a little bit too much precision, but really, if you have this incredibly precise foundation stroke that you can control beautifully like that, then you can add and subtract things from it like crazy. A lot of people drift all the time when they cast, particularly if they're using a more vertical stroke. I tend to use a little bit of drift or layback oftentimes in my fishing casts, at least if I'm using a more vertically oriented stroke. If I'm going more sidearm, I may or may not use that. It depends on the situation. But I think, Chuck, if that is helping you right now, go ahead and use that. It's something you'll certainly use in your fishing, and then you can work on that extreme precision of the stroke as you go along.
And that also is changing as you get more line out, that timing, right?
Oh, yes, it is. Most definitely.
It's not a constant. If you're letting line out, it's actually changing every time you take another stroke.
It is. The timing is indeed changing, as will be the general overall stroke length and what we call rod arc, basically the starting and stopping positions of the fly rod. All right. The actual motion of the fly cast isn't a big sweeping arc in the air, but we use that term. So, there are a lot of things that change as distance changes. Trajectory among them, which we've already talked about, and so forth. So, yeah, we think, wow, there's so many factors. It's so complicated. How am I going to do it? Well, you know what? The human body is amazingly adaptable, and as we go along, it usually doesn't take us very long to begin to figure things out. I mean, if you watch a forward cast unroll in front of you, that's about how long it takes the back cast of the same length to unroll behind you. So that's one way you can sort of use a visual reference to gauge what's going on behind you without actually having to turn around and look. I mean, there are a lot of factors, but like I said, we're amazingly adaptable, and once we begin to understand what has to happen, we can begin to adjust our bodies pretty fast to figure out what we need to do.
Okay, next question. Phil Panko in Kaysen, Minnesota says, Jason, one of my biggest challenges is getting a short cast in the right spot and drifting properly. The cast always seems so short that the line is on the water before I can do a proper reach cast in an air mend. I also seem to have troubles mending the line without pulling it out of place. Can you offer some suggestions for me to practice to improve these challenges?
Okay, short cast. Okay, this is going to be a stroke length and trajectory issue, number one. And by that, what I mean is, as we lengthen the cast or shorten the cast, we have to change our total stroke length. That means the amount we move our arm back and forth. In fact, in extremely short distances, my rod is moving only a very short angle change from the start of the back cast to the end of the forward cast. It may be very short. In fact, sometimes so short it almost doesn't look right, but the line goes exactly where it needs to go and the loops are just fine. As you get the cast longer and longer, that angle and that distance of the rod being moved begins to change and becomes longer and longer. Also, with that shorter stroke, and just practice making your actual casting stroke shorter as you cast shorter and shorter distances. Also adjust your trajectory so that you're not necessarily aiming out over the water, but almost right down onto it. By doing that, as soon as the fly unrolls, it's just right above the water's surface. It doesn't have to drift down 5 or 6 feet. I mean, if you're only casting 15 feet and you're casting 5 or 6 feet over the top of the water, just on a regular old cast, there's a lot that can happen in that 5 or 6 feet, particularly if the wind is blowing, you're trying to be accurate, the fish are in a very tiny spot, and so forth. So adjusting stroke length, adjusting your trajectory, and then once you get the fly heading toward the target, make your mends. I see you're talking about here about in-the-air mends. I see you listing those. So obviously you're already doing that type of thing. But as you make an in-the-air mend, you have to let some line slide out. Basically, you're shooting line as you're making the mend. If you don't, you wind up pulling the fly off target. Okay? I almost hate to bring this up, high school geometry. I can hear the screams now. No, the hypotenuse, right? Yeah, well, basically, if you make one of those mends, right, especially right or left, you'll actually pull the fly off target unless you shoot some line as the line loop is unrolling. Then, basically, the slack is being shot into the line. As the rod tip is moving right or left, the fly goes right where it's supposed to go. Since you've got your trajectory right, all the slack lands on the water, and you're ready to go from right there.
And then he also talks about mending the line. I don't know if he was talking about that in the air as well or on the water.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
In the air we just covered. If it's on the water,
right.
On the water can be tricky. That really comes down to, again, letting some line slide out as you make the actual mend itself. Okay, you're actually introducing a little bit more slack. That helps to prevent the fly from being pulled out of place. But you can also use what I typically refer to as directed mending. I'm sure other anglers have different descriptions for it, but That is very carefully moving that slack by essentially making a very small underpowered cast in the direction with that slack to go. So rather than trying to flop the slack from one place to the other using these big flopping motions of the rod tip, which at 20 feet, you flop the line, you're going to pull the fly. This will be a little thick of the rod tip, just a little thick, and literally with your hand in a casting position, thick to the right, thick to the left, so that you just move just the slack that you want to with a great control versus trying to simply, like I said, flop large amounts of line back and forth.
Well, what you said was really a mental picture for me, is because if you've got that line out and then you're trying to put, 4 feet of a loop in there or an arc in it, you can't help but move the fly unless you let more line out. So,
yeah.
I mean, that just, it makes sense when you start to think about it on the river. You're not thinking sometimes, but.
Right. And if you can put all the slack on the water first, too, with an in-the-air mend, like a curve
mend. Yeah, it's the best, right.
That's it, because then all the slack's already there.
Yeah.
All you have to do is just reposition it. It's a possibility you'll move the fly, but, again, you've probably went out and practiced for half an hour. You might be amazed at where you wound up. Not worrying about fishing, just practicing moving that slack in a controlled manner. Sometimes it's amazing what you can stumble upon just doing your own work. So get out and think about those possibilities. Go for it.
Let's see. One of the questions that came in was from Craig, looks like Mernitz in Phoenix, Arizona, that came in online while we've been talking. He says, how do
Great.
You cast and mend in high CFF moving water, 5,000 to 10,000 CFF? And I'm not sure that we didn't already address this, but maybe you want to talk to that.
Yeah, 5 to 10,000 in the Mississippi probably wouldn't be much, but put 5 to 10,000 in a smaller stream, and then you've got some serious trouble trying to get that fly to drift without serious drag. Like I tell people, there's this whole other world of mending that we oftentimes don't think about or are not introduced to. Because oftentimes we think about trout fishing, and I presume that since we're talking about flowing waters, we're probably talking about trout in this case. At least I hope we are, because that's what I'm going to talk about. We think about mending as a sort of either an after-the-cast thing once all the line's already down, in which case it becomes more difficult because all the line's already on the water, or we think about it being these small little manipulations of the rod tip, very delicate kinds of things. Look, in a situation like that, where you're talking serious water, you got to use that rod like a fencing foil, and you got to move that thing. You would be absolutely amazed how much line you can manipulate with a 2-foot-long arm and a 9-foot-long fly rod, particularly if it's done in the air. So the line loop is unrolling. In fact, you can actually watch this. If you see somebody doing in the air mends or doing it yourself, you can actually watch the line loop. There it goes in the air. Boom, just right there, out in front of me. And I can then almost peel the line away from that line loop. It's kind of a cool thing to watch as it's unrolling by mending out to the sides. Now, I might mend out to the side by reaching my body out and my arm, okay? So there's more like 3 feet, okay? I move my body, leaned over a foot, put my arm out, that's 2 feet at least, plus a 9-foot rod. All of a sudden, I've got this 12-foot long lever sticking out there to manipulate the line. And if I put some more energy into that, I can actually throw these big, sweeping curves of line. It's amazing sometimes, if you've not done it before, not seen it done, how much effect you can really have before that fly line ever touches down out there. So in a situation like that, I might throw a very, very broad curve mend, big stuff. I mean, really reaching way over and back, letting line fly out as I do so. So I put slack on the water and don't change the direction of where the fly is headed. And those kind of situations, you can do some amazing stuff. And then, of course, once all of a sudden the line's on the water, well, it's not going to stay perfect forever, I mean, particularly if it's complex drag. So then, right away, proactively, you got to be thinking, okay, I've got my slack. I may have some extra slack here in front of me. What do I need to do next? Okay, I can see already what's happening with the fly line. My curve mend's going to help me, but right there, aha, I've got a belly forming right there. So throw some slack right back onto that belly. Keep watching the fly. There it is again. Okay, kick it out there again. One little flick of the rod tip with the slack right on that belly. Perfect, perfect. Keep watching the fly. Bloop, nose sticks out. You got them. So really get after it. You might be amazed at what can happen.
Terrific, terrific. Okay, we've got to take another break, so give me a few seconds, and we'll be right back. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net, or email Pudge at Pudge, that's P-U-D-G-E, at womensflyfishing.net, or the phone number there is 907-274-7113, 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jason Borger about casting, mending, and presentation for difficult angling situations. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately and try to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. Okay, Jason, we've got we're still talking mending. We've got a one here from Ted Hasselbring in Nashville, Tennessee. When casting across stream seams of different speeds, how do you detect when micro drag occurs? It's often easy to see when your fly begins to drag out, but in reading about micro drag, it seems that there is not always visual evidence micro drag is occurring. So how do you detect it and how do you avoid it?
Sometimes you detect it by watching the fish come up under your fly and then jerk away at the last second and not take it. Then you know you've got micro drag. Oftentimes, if the fly is not right, they'll kind of glance up and whatever. But sometimes if you're getting micro drag, they'll come up right to the fly and then at the last second, ugh, man, that's it. They don't want it. Something's happened, and oftentimes that's an unfortunate signal that you've had micro drag. But how do you figure it out otherwise? Well, I'll tell you what. It's not always an easy answer. I know, however, if I'm watching the end of the line and as much of the leader as I can see, if parts of that start to come really straight, I'm guessing I am either getting micro drag or I am about to get micro drag. In fact, I'm probably about to get macro drag at that point. you know, I'm talking, you know, your 18 Calabita sports a Evan Rudin burns out of there.
Exactly.
I mean, everybody's seen it. You know, you see it all the time. I see it all the time. It's just part of fishing. But some other ways around. Well, like I said, watch the end of the fly line, you know, because that's connected directly to the leader. If the end of the fly line suddenly is straight, there's no more S-curve in it at all, you can guess that the next thing that's going to come straight is the butt of the leader, and then the midsection, and then the tippet. If you're fishing a 10 or 12-foot leader and you've gotten a good series of S-curves, you might get another second or two out of that. If you're just floating down and things look right, but you fish are refusing, or you think you're getting micro drag, sometimes what I'll do is cast in such a way that I know I'm getting as much slack right at the end of the leader and tippet as possible. So I'll do a relatively high-aimed puddle cast or puddle mend, because really the action that makes it work is more related to that downward drop of the rod tip as the loop is unrolling, so that I get this almost vertical drop of the line and leader, and the line and the leader to the water. So I know that out there I've got the absolute most S-curves I can possibly get in the system. Then I know that as the fly goes over the fish, that I'm probably getting the best drag reduction I can. If it keeps going over and I know I have the right fly and the fish still isn't taking, because I think, you know, I've got to be getting something because the fish isn't looking at it, or the fish is turning away at the last second, I'll change my approach position and try to get into another presentation angle that's going to allow me to put the fly in there with, I think, more confidence in terms of the drag situation. That may be more upstream, that may be more downstream. But again, just trying to make a cast that you can visually see as much slack as possible out at the end of the line of leader will give you probably your best chances at avoiding micro drag. That and using either a longer and or finer leader and tippet, that will also help.
Well, you've just led into my next question. How does the length of your leader affect the cast, or does it? And do you need to accommodate for shorter versus longer leader in your cast?
Sure. All you need to do to find out whether or not length of the leader affects your cast is just to cut your leader off the end of the line and go cast. And that'll tell you right away what happens. Okay? Number one. Number two, will length of leader affect your cast? Sure. If you really want to see something, right after you've cut the leader off the end of your line, I made a few casts, then go and tie a 20-foot long leader on the end of your line. See what happens. It becomes fairly obvious pretty quickly what's going on. I mean, you've got this object with very little mass out there that's being propelled through the air, covering all this air resistance, and there's a fly back there. A fly may be very air resistant, or it might just be a, you know, a big hunk of lead that's going to sort of go its own way, and the leader's not going to have a whole lot to say about it. Typically, when you're starting to go with short and thick leaders, they tend to kick around pretty fast. When you're going with real long, real thin leaders, they tend to sort of wilt out there. Now, each one of those can be beneficial depending on the situation. You know, if we go from real short and thick, you might want to have a leader that turns over like a shot, just slaps a bass bug down. We might be talking 18 inches. I mean, just a hunk of mono attached to the end of the line, splat. You know, you can throw that fly down. There's not a lot to get tangled. It's right there at the end of the line. You have great control. Another situation, you might want a leader that goes out there and wilts. We were just talking about it. Microdrag. Killer. So do everything you can to help prevent it within reason. I mean, obviously, if you can't cast a super long leader or a super thin leader, don't do it. You know, work on your presentation angle and so forth to compensate. In those cases, you don't want a perfectly poker straight leader. So, hey, it's fine if it goes out there and like I said, wilts a little bit, falls to the surface in a series of S curves. And in between, you've got these sort of middle of the road leaders, this sort of, you know, 7.5 to 12 footers, someplace in there that can be tuned to do different types of things. You know, you might want a relatively delicate presentation with the dry flies. You might tune to be thinner. You might want to have be casting something like a, you know, a Clouser minnow or something on the end of it. And you want to, you know, you can be casting fairly long, but you want to have a fairly long leader. All right, get a nice turnover, keeps the end of the fly line away from the fish and so forth. Then you might go with a much heavier butt section just so that you have a little bit extra mass and so forth to turn
when
the fly
you,
over.
Talking about length of leaders, what's the longest you would use, and is there a point where you just can't manage that leader anymore because of, like you say, that, you know, you're just not dealing with much mass there?
Yeah. Typically, for most of my, well, for example, most of my fishing, I mean, we'll call that trout, salmon, salt, brim, bass, whatever. I mean, I'm typically not going a whole lot longer than maybe 14 or 15 feet. I mean, that's pretty extreme. I mean, I'll fish spring creeks with 10, 11-foot leaders without any trouble. And I'll cast, you know, like I said, clousers and so forth on leaders that are in that mid-range. You know, if you just want to get the fly down to the bottom in a hurry, you might just be talking 9 feet of almost straight mono. Just put it right down on the bottom. So I don't tend to go terribly long unless it's just a really super specialty situation where the drag is just hideous or if you need to get a fly down in a hurry in extremely deep water. That's one possibility. For example, in still waters, you might actually go with an 18 or 20-foot leader. And then that brings us to the second question. How is that to cast? Horrible is the answer, particularly if it's a shorter cast. It's just very difficult to get that stuff to behave. In those cases, using a tension cast, some people call it a water haul, for instance, basically flopping the back cast down in the water, use the water tension to flick the forward cast forward. That can help you deal with longer leaders. But if you're casting short ways and you have a fairly long leader, you may actually need to impart more casting energy than you'd normally expect to do for, say, a 20 or 25-foot cast, just to make sure the leader turns over enough to get to the target.
Because if you're dealing with a 15-foot leader and you've got a 30-foot cast, you've only got 15 feet of line to actually send it out there, right? That's not a whole lot of line.
That's not a whole lot of line.
Yeah.
No, it isn't. So, hey, you know, we go right back to hauling again, don't we? Yeah, all the way back there.
You
know, forget the tarpon. We're talking about trout at 30 feet, but you better know how to haul so you can get that long leader to at least the butt section to turn over a bit and get the fly to target. But still, the leader goes out there and kind of goes, and piles down. Looks terrible, but, you know, the trout love it because it's either no drag or a greatly reduced drag, and up they come. Of course, that always comes into play. But then as soon as the fly swings down below you and you're walking from place to place, you know, on the toughest spring creek in the world, like a 20-inch brown takes the flies. It's just dragging in the water, so go figure, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
exactly.
Yeah, when you're trying to untangle your reel or something.
Sure.
Yeah.
You go through all these careful drag-free presentations, and then you know the biggest fish the trip takes to fly when it's just hanging down below you someplace.
Yeah.
That kind of thing happens. And, you know, that speaks volumes of fish behavior. Hey, it looked alive. It was in the surface. I came up and ate it. But during a hatch situation.
Sorry, you weren't ready, right?
You weren't ready. Goodbye. But during a hatch situation, I'm going to place my bets on the guy that, or woman that can place that fly with drag reduction, right. Great drag reduction, over just dragging your fly around on the surface. Although, yeah,
well,
sometimes it's fun to nail them.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a question that came in from online here while we're talking. Earl Schenberg of St. Louis, he says, I fish local water in Missouri and have explored a furled leader. What is your opinion of these leaders for distance accuracy and presentation in cold water fishing?
Okay, I actually have a whole vest full of furled leaders. I also have a whole vest full of monofilament, both nylon and some fluoro spools, just because I like to experiment and do a lot of different things with leader materials. Furled, and actually some of the furled I have are designed to turn over almost exactly like long mono leaders, which I guess in some ways kind of defeats the purpose of furled leaders, doesn't it? But nonetheless, furls are extremely supple. I mean, even out of monofilament, they can be extraordinarily supple. Most of the ones I have are thread. They just unroll beautifully. You can hand cast them. I mean, all sorts of parlor tricks with the things. I think for a lot of people, that suppleness helps with their presentation. Particularly if you don't have a lot of practice time in with a lot of the more advanced men's and that sort of thing. I mean, they can really help that way. I also think that their suppleness and the way they unroll can even help with larger flies. I know I've got people that fish grasshoppers. I know people that fish furled leaders for tarpon. In fact, we were doing some of that down in Mexico recently, fishing not necessarily a furl in a traditional sense, but a twisted leader, so a very similar type of arrangement. So they can be used in all sorts of different environments. In cold water, the only thing I would say is when it comes to the furls, don't try to just cast them arrow straight. I mean, they are very supple, which is terrific. But if you cast them absolutely arrow straight and you've only got a two-foot tippet on there, well, then you've basically cast your tippet arrow straight as well. So, you know, you've got this very durable, very supple leader that you can put a zillion tippets onto before the thing is worn out, and I think a lot of people really like them for that purpose. The downside is, of course, is that when you tie one on, if you want to change the performance of the leader, other than changing the length of the tippet, for instance, which you can certainly do, and that will alter how things turn over at the end, then you've got to switch out leaders. One of the things I like about mono, just because I can tune it on the water very, very quickly, but I think that all leaders do have their places, including, you know, braided sinking leaders and all sorts of things like that. So if you're finding good success with your furls and you're finding that they're giving you more delicate presentations and you're finding that they're helping with your drag situation, by all means, use them. And don't be afraid to experiment a little bit either. There are some pretty cool furled leaders out there, including some long stuff that really has a very soft, subtle turnover. I thought that they were very nice. So, again, it's like most things in fly fishing. Some people find something they really like, stick with it. Me, I like to use the leader that best suits the situation. But I tend to be a customizer, you know. So I tend to spend more of my time with monofilaments than I do necessarily with furls or braids. But that's just me.
Okay. Well, we've got another question here. Captain Bob Jaspers again from East Central Florida. How do you deal with extremely close-up fish that require a fast presentation?
Without spooking them, I presume that's also
yeah,
in there
I think
as
that's
well.
Part of the question, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Well, there are a number of ways to do it, but when I think I know exactly what he's talking about here. I require a fast presentation. Well, you need to be ready. Number one, ready means not having your fly on the hook keeper with all the leader knots wound through the tip top guide. Okay, get some line out.
Come
get
on,
all the
Jason.
Leader knots out of the guides first. All right, guides love it when you're actually prepared. Trust me. Hold the fly. Between thumb and forefinger, hook point up. Okay, I'm going to repeat that again. Hook point up. Hold it hook point down one time. You'll never forget to hold it hook point up again. Okay? So now you have some line out of the rod tip. You're ready to go. At a moment's notice, you can already cast. The leader's out of the guides. You're not trying to cast mono. You're already casting fly line. It helps, actually, if you've got a bit more fly line out of the rod tip. Not so much that you're necessarily dragging the water with it because, of course, you know what will happen. If you can be on an absolute dead flat sand bottom, and somehow the fly line will hook on something floating on the surface, guaranteed. So just be ready, but don't be so ready you've got 70 feet of fly line hanging in the water, okay? When the time comes, you make one, either one back cast or one forward cast. Depends on what people like to do. Me personally, my first cast, I want it to be my back cast because I'm going to shoot some line to that back cast and shoot line into the forward cast, and I'm ready to go. I mean, a lot of times you can hit fish close with a single casting cycle. No false cast at all. Flies in your hand, fish. Guide yells, 11 o'clock, you know, okay, extremely close, 20 feet, right there, now, go. You just go flick into your back cast. As soon as you go flick with the tip of the fly rod, you let go of the fly, boom, goes right around your body. And when I say right around your body, don't hold the fly down here by your left side on your belt and expect, as a right-handed caster, for that fly to come all the way up and around and go where it's supposed to go. Most likely, it'll just sink into your side. Get your hand out in front of you. Okay, so your left hand, for example, is out in front of you holding that fly. So when you go around to make that back cast, you can let it go, and it's not going to hook up on anything. Okay? Then, one forward cast, flick, shoot a little line if you have to, you're right there. Sometimes you don't get the luxury. Sometimes, you know, you've just gotten everything back together. Maybe you landed a fish. Maybe you've just moved the boat, right? You had to crank up because you're going across the flats or whatever it is. You just get up. You stand on the platform. The guide says, fish! Now, and we've only got 3 seconds, what do? Okay, first you panic, and that should last about a half a second, then you get yourself wits about you, grab the fly off the hook keeper, okay, strip a little line out, pull it out, pull that line out through the guides, and then you can pull line from the reel as you make a back cast, okay, your hands go in opposite directions, it's almost like a haul, really, okay, but you strip a line from the reel, okay, as you come forward, you shoot that line, back cast, strip more line from the reel, it's your left hand moving away from your right, right back out, you can have 20 feet or 30 feet of line out of the broad tip in no time at all.
Simple.
Simple. Right. You know, and the biggest red fish of your life is only 20 feet away, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Except if that's a 150-pound tarpon out there.
Sure, of course.
And the sweat's,
you know,
in your eyes. And
yeah. No, it's only the fish of a lifetime. Don't worry about it. It's fine. Yeah, right. Everybody gets jelly when that happens.
Yeah, let's switch to a little subtler situation here. Tim McDermott in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Jason. I fish predominantly small limestone creeks in eastern PA. I often find some of the better lies are under overhanging vegetation. Though I attempt to drift the fly through these stretches by casting up and across upstream of the vegetation, I usually end up having an unnatural drift occur before the fly gets to the feeding lane. Any suggestions?
I'm just looking at the question here, too, just to make sure. It's a fairly long question to make sure I've got everything.
It sounds like he's got a canopy going over there.
Yeah, under overhanging vegetation, drifted through the fly, through the casting, up and across. There are a couple solutions here. If you have to continue casting up and across, cast closer to the fish. I mean, that may sound like a flippant answer, but if you're getting unnatural drift before the fly gets to the fish, if you're getting, let's say, 2 feet adrift, and all of a sudden you got unnatural drift, and then the fish is 3 feet away, cast a foot in front of the fish instead. Now, that could also result in you lining the fish or spooking the fish. So that might not work. Try down and across. Again, I can't necessarily see the presentation situation, and sometimes that doesn't work either. In those types of cases, trying to get as much slack out there at the end as possible is key. That could be a puddleman, for instance, what we call a puddle cast, so that you get a lot of line just piling or puddling down on those nice S-curves, that can do great things for you. And if you've got something that you can use in the water, some sort of obstacle, maybe a little pad of weeds, maybe a rock, something that you can lay the line over, you know what? All of a sudden, instead of making a 30-foot cast, you've made maybe a 10-foot cast because the line is using that as an anchor point. And if you can do that, you may be able to actually get a better drift rather than trying to cast around that obstacle. The only problem is, of course, getting your fly back. But usually, unless the obstacle is only a foot or two from the end of the line, you can typically get the fly back off of that kind of stuff without too much difficulty. So consider those possibilities. Fly closer to the fish. So in other words, just changing your accuracy a little bit. Adding more slack by changing the type of cast / mend that you're using. Potentially changing your position in the stream, going from up and across to down and across, and or utilizing some sort of obstacle or some sort of current tongue potentially to help you adjust the attack angle of the fly line in relation to the fish and in relation to you.
It's that time again, Jason. A little break here, and we'll be right back. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties, that's T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jason Borger about casting, mending, and presentation for difficult angling solutions. If you do have a question, just go to our homepage, fill out that Q&A text box, and send us your question. We'll receive it immediately, and we'll try to answer it on the show tonight if we can. Well, great. We're working through these. Let's just keep at it here, Jason.
George.
Okay. Brian Charles Wagner in Aztec, New Mexico, says he's a San Juan local.
All right.
He knows all about all those big fish in the San Juan.
Absolutely.
I really struggle with proper mending when nymphing and have got what I perceive to be a lot of conflicting mending info from old-timers, young studs, shows, and magazines. What is your take on
combo.
This subject? Yeah.
Oh, boy. Proper mending when nymphing. Got three or four shows we can devote to that? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, Brian, there are a number of things we could talk about. But really, the proper mend, and again, this isn't really trying to be flippant. It's just trying to get you to think about this in a critical way. Think about this from your own perspective. The proper mend with nymphing is the one that makes the fly behave in the way it needs to behave. Okay? So if that nymph is an organism that would be actively swimming, then you might want to mend in a way or actually present the fly in a way so that that imitation will actively swim. If that nymph is supposed to be something that is a bottom-dwelling insect that is going to be bouncing along the bottom and then in between the rocks and so forth, then you need to mend in a way, for example, an upstream mend, to allow that fly to sink and stay down there. And if the nymph is supposed to be an imitation of a in-the-process of a hatch type of organism where you've got something ascending from the bottom of the river to the top of the river and you want to impart a little motion, or you know the fish have stratified in a mid-level. They're not down at the bottom sniffing around, but they're not really at the top yet. They're kind of looking in those mid-waters. You want your fly to be there. Then you may need to mend in a way that allows your fly to sink to a certain level and sort of hold that position. That can be a tough one because, you know, you get a little drag, it pulls the fly up, you get too much slack, boom, the fly goes right down. But by weighting the fly in certain ways, perhaps even going with an unweighted fly and maybe greasing the leader or using a fly suspension device, you may be able to adjust what's going on in addition to adjusting the mend. So,
well, that makes a lot of difference too, though, Jason, is if you do use an indicator of some sort, a fly suspension device, then that's going to change your mend as well, right?
It will, particularly if you're going, for example, if I'm going to fish down on the bottom and I'm going to put a couple shot on or something to help anchor the fly down there and let it sort of tumble along the bottom, and I may use an indicator to an out. I'm not just necessarily talking here about the bobber style indicator where I'm actually trying to hold the fly at depth, but I'm actually talking about a drift indicator that's telling me sort of where my fly is, how fast it's moving in relation to the surface currents, what it's doing down there. If I'm using it from that way, I may actually cast up and throw a big mend, like a roll cast mend or a flopping mend up there so that the indicator itself serves as the anchor point on the surface. And I'll throw that mend right up to the indicator, and then I know that I've got all that slack line up above the indicator. Hey, if it's above the indicator right after I make the cast, it's also going to be above the fly. That fly is going to go right to the bottom right away. And then I can begin to watch that indicator and watch what else is going on with the line and leader, to see if a fish is interested. So there are a number of different ways to approach that. Some with and some without indicators, and also thinking about what does the fly really need to be doing, and then adjusting both your presentation angle and the mends to make it do those types of things.
Okay.
I'm sorry I can't be a whole lot more specific than that because it's situation dependent.
Right, exactly. Jeff Johnson, Glendora, California. How often do you practice your casting, and how do you learn your tricks for casting?
Practice my casting every day. And sometimes you say, well, you can't practice your casting every day because you're flying or it's 20 below outside or whatever. Sure you can. You can practice inside without a rod and reel. You practice in pantomime. So I practice every single day. And typically I'm practicing foundation casting stroke no matter what. I always go back to my core, practice that, and then practice other types of things as well. How do you learn your tricks for casting? Practice. I know that goes right back around. Circular argument, right? Well, actually getting out and working through those tricks. And the trick to learning tricks is going slowly and working on key elements, one piece at a time, one piece at a time, over and over again, and being self-critical. Sometimes you got to step away from yourself as you cast and really look at what's going on and say, you know what, self, you're not doing this one thing, and this one thing is going to let you accomplish what you want. So what you need to do is get a hold of your body and force your body to do things a little bit differently. And at first it feels terribly awkward. Your body doesn't want to comply. And then all of a sudden things begin to happen. And pretty soon you can begin to repeat those things. And all of a sudden your new trick, whether it be some new mend or some new type of cast that adds some little curve or pile or puddle or some neat Z effect or whatever it is that you want to accomplish, whether it's simply to make yourself a more competent caster from the perspective of control. You may never use the cast, but you may actually want to practice it just to give yourself better control. Or from the perspective of, hey, now I know how I can catch that fish that was hanging out in that one spot. I can use the corkscrew curve cast and put it in there. Now I can figure out how to do it. Yeah, those things come step by step. And they also come by sometimes watching other people. I mean, I love to cast with other casters, particularly other casters that are doing some really interesting things, people that I know about. I like watching them cast. I like watching what they're doing. I have them tell me what they're doing. I'll work through what it is that they're doing in slow-mo, and for me, I'll try to pick out things that I find that might be awkward at first and just slowly work through them, adjust, and then all of a sudden you've got it.
Well, Jason, I'm going to jump down here to I put this question in.
Go for it.
Because I read in your book and about this, and I think this kind of, by you describing this, you'll be able to expand upon what you just said, which is, you know, at times there might be things that you have to combine or adapt to get the effect. And what I'm referring to you is because we know that you were one of the shadow casters in the movie A River Runs Through It. Describe your challenges that day when you were trying to do that piece for the movie, because in your book you describe, I think, a combination of three different things that were going on there and to get to one final goal or effect that you wanted to get.
Well, that particular cast, the shadow cast, which if people haven't seen the film or read the book, I mean, the book is fantastic. You should really read it if you haven't read it. That cast sort of began before I was hired on the film, and it sort of developed as various people had their hand in it. And then eventually, once I actually performed the cast itself on camera, I went through a few final little miscellaneous tweaks on the river. And I think the most difficult thing for that particular skill was actually that the backhanded, if you watch the film, this backhanded forward cast where the line has to come and swing around the body and sort of make this halo effect, because that's what the book talks about, this halo of line around Paul's body and so forth. Putting all that together and keeping all that aloft with a relatively soft rod, I think was probably the most challenging aspect. Combining all those elements into one thing required, you know, thinking through everything ahead of time, thinking through what's going to happen, what's the timing, what does the rod have to feel like, and so forth, and then actually getting out there and just giving everything enough time. And I think that for a lot of people, there's the mindset of rushing. Now, that's not necessarily a conscious mindset, but we tend to, especially if there's a fish in front of us, you know, in this case, there's supposed to be this giant rainbow out there waiting to grab Paul's fly, right? So we get this idea of rushing the cast and rushing through all the motions because, hey, we want to get the fly on the water. You know, the longer the fly is on the water, the greater chance we have a fish taking it, we hope. But in a cast like that, which was this combination of these different pieces, parts from other casts, to make this big, sweeping, slow thing, you really had to relax, calm down, let everything happen. Let the rod unload, let the line loop unroll, wait for it to unroll, let it get down there, turn the body, you know, sweep the rod around, wait for the line to get back to this position because I know it has to be there so I can come to this position and so forth. And I think the lesson there for difficult presentation casts is take your time, think through it first, then just let things happen, don't try to rush them, put everything in where it needs to go, and you'll be amazed at how well things can come together once you just take a breath, relax, and do what you need to do.
Well, I think in your description in the book, you know, knowing how different types of casts work and being able to combine them to get your effect, and granted, this was all for movies, but my thinking is the more techniques you know, even if you don't use them very often, come into play in those difficult situations where you can say, hey, I wonder if I did this and this, maybe I can pull this off. So the more you practice, the more you learn, the more effective you could probably be on the water.
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. Particularly if you start doing the casts combined with mens and think through the situation proactively beforehand. Because you know, there are times when the situation may seem impossible, but there are a lot of casts and a lot of mens out there that have been devised over the years. And being able to execute those as you need to, even if it's only a couple times a season, can sometimes put you onto a fish you may never have had a chance at before. So learning to combine skills and put them together into a whole skill sequence from the time you make the first back cast until you actually make the last mend before you're going to pick up and cast again. Learning all the tricks in there can do all sorts of things for you in difficult angling situations. I think I would also say that sometimes nonsense practice, just going and doing line manipulation, cool stuff, fun stuff. You know, you can take for example, spey, all right? I mean, you've got all the core casts, but then you can do this crazy stuff with spey casts, all these wild spirals and everything else that you may or may not ever really use fishing. But it's a great way, I find it personally a great way, to work on control of the fly line, positioning, and so forth, so that I build a generalized control skill set that underlies everything else. So whether I'm just doing it a straight overhead cast or if I'm just putting in a certain type of mend, I still have this underlying control stuff that I've been working on all along that just gives me a better sense of what's going on with the fly rod and the fly line. And I have fun doing it. You know, it's great to go out there and mess around.
Okay, let's try to get a few more of these questions
yep.
in.
Let's go for it.
Joe Sloboda, Lorain, Ohio, on a recent trip last week to Wilmington, New York, and the Au Sable, I encountered drought conditions, extremely low water. I found myself fishing the pocket water and the deeper runs. What strategies might I employ if I encountered these conditions again? He doesn't really say what problem he was having, but maybe you can just talk about pocket water and deeper runs there for a second.
Let's see. Yeah, really low water, that's basically all you've got left is the pockets around the boulders at that point and,
right.
and deep slices.
And that is a challenge I've always found, too. You know, how do you get that fly into where the fish are?
Typically, you know, you're going to be casting, unless the fish, you know, the fish are extremely spooky, you're probably casting a relatively short line so that you're accurate. And that's one of the keys. If the fish are going to be in very defined areas, just casting and being kind of accurate isn't going to cover the water in the way you need to cover it. You need to be able to put that fly right where it needs to go. And utilizing something like a tuck cast, which will get the fly down in a hurry, and then trying to have as little line on the water as possible will also help that fly not only get down, but will also help prevent drag from pulling it up out of those deep pockets or those you know those deep cuts, so that the fly is right there on the bottom at all times. You know, if you can fish in such a way that basically it's only the leader that's down there, even better yet, they don't have any fly line on the water at all causing drag problems. But sometimes you can't get quite that close. Utilizing a fly or maybe a multi-fly rig, a fly that's either very heavy so it gets down quickly, or a multi-fly rig that utilizes one very heavy fly and then one or two lighter flies. That's a technique that's sort of been perfected by Europeans in their fishing. I mean, they really can walk those flies, literally. Put a heavy fly on so heavy it goes right to the bottom. You can literally walk that fly right along the bottom with those two smaller flies hanging up there in the midwaters. So from my perspective, I'm going to tell you, you know, get as close as you can and be as accurate as you can. As little line on the water as possible, or at least be very proactive in your mending, both aerial and then following up with significant on-the-water mending to make sure that you're getting as little line drag as possible to pull that fly out of position. And then you may want to consider altering your equipment slightly, perhaps a long, very thin leader. Some people even just go with a 9 or 10 foot-long straight hunk of mono off the end of the fly line so that they can get the fly down in a hurry. Doesn't cast very well, but you know you can do the job if you're up close and personal. And then just making sure that you run that fly through there more than three times. Sometimes it's amazing, you know. Being patient, working each area, particularly if the fish will hold up and they're not moving very far, work it through all those areas. Maybe even adjust your presentation angle. Go down through it, then go up through it. Okay?
Do you find, Jason, that fish in those behind boulders and so forth are a little less spooky? I mean, because of the water flowing there and breaking up, can you get closer without disturbing them?
Yeah, oftentimes you can. Depends on the flows we're talking about. I've caught fish, like someplace like the Madison, even when it's been low and really clear late August. Going out there and fishing around the boulders, particularly in lower light conditions, not necessarily in the bright sunny days, but lower light conditions, you can catch them right off the rod tip. In fact, a couple times when I've been out there in really low water, I've gone fishing right at evening and actually walked the fly through some of those types of areas right around the boulders, right where I know there's a deep cut, with my eyes closed, not using an indicator or anything like that, just using a long fin leader and literally just ticking the fly along the bottom, and all of a sudden the tick becomes a talk and set the hook and you got him. So talk about blind nymphing, right?
Right.
Even looking. Sure.
Right. Okay. I'm going to skip down here a little bit because we are getting close. And I'm going to hit these two because these were from, I think, our last show that we didn't address. And they have to do with kind of fighting and landing, but that kind of plays into this. Jeffrey Biller asks, what's the best way to set a hook on a trout? Should I employ different strike techniques for each different form of fly, dry, nymph, streamer? That's also kind of a broad. A lot of answers to that question.
Well, there's some broad topics tonight, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, best way to set a hook on a trout. Well, I guess it really depends on what they're doing and how they're rising. And also, if they're not rising, how are they taking underwater? And if are there any obstacles? And what kind of leader are you using? and on it goes, right? Oftentimes for dry fly takes, particularly if it's with lighter leaders, lighter tippets, I'll use a slip strike. Little line actually slide out of the rod guides as I raise the rod tip. And if I raise the rod tip, I don't necessarily mean straight up. I might mean off to the sides as well, depending if there's obstacles or if I want to move the fish's head a little bit. Or if I just happen to be in a position where I can't raise the rod tip up, I have a canopy over me. You're never going to raise the rod tip up to set the hook. You got to set to the side. Occasionally, I have had a fish take instantaneously with all the slack on the water, and then what the heck do you do? I either do a snap cast or a roll cast. Snap like that, and you can set the hook in them. If you're, for example, fishing with a big streamer fly of some sort, and you get fish that are sort of following and knocking at it but not getting a hold of it, if you feel a tick, don't yank back and rip the streamer out of there. Okay, just wait a second. Keep working the fly. Let him get a hold of it. When the line gets heavy, then tighten up. Sometimes tighten up with the butt of the fly rod to make sure if it's a big fish that you get that hook home and that you're already fighting him with the butt of the rod. And I've done that type of thing when striking trout that were in very difficult situations where I knew if I just gave them a little bit of a tip strike and sort of just lifted the fly rod that they were going to just go, yeah, right, and go back underneath something. So I actually set the hook to the side about as strong as I dared, and it was just enough just to change the attitude of the fish's head a little bit. And then the fish, when it bolted, actually came out into clear water instead of going back into the junk, which would have broken me off right away. Like I said, it's a broad topic. I mean,
yep,
I fished in France one time, and these guys were like, strike before they take. Thanks,
yeah,
guys. So, yeah,
well,
it varies good.
Yeah, a couple more. I want to give one thing I didn't give you a chance to tell folks about what you're doing right now in the fly fishing world. And also, do you still have books available, and can people get those?
Yeah. Books, just come to my website, jasonborger.com. I actually have a new blog, too. Hey, I just started a new blog on my website, so you can come and check that out. I've got a bunch of posts from the recent FFR show that are going to go up probably tonight or tomorrow, too. Come in and read that. On the front page of my website, there's an offer, $20 shipped in the U.S. I'll personalize it for you, send it out. If you're listening from another country, it's $15, but you have to pay actual shipping. And airmail's not cheap. So that's why I offer the book a little bit less for international listeners. So just come right there. If you're in the U.S., just click the buy, go right ahead. Otherwise, you can also email me, and we can get things figured out. And what I'm doing in fly fishing, well, beyond the Fly Casting Institute and that type of thing, I don't know, hanging out at shows. I guess it's the last thing I was doing in Denver. That was a good time, actually. Lots of new products, all sorts of good stuff. Oh, yeah.
Lots of good people there and so forth.
Definitely a good time.
Good time. Well, tell them a little bit about the Fly Casting Institute.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, the Fly Casting Institute is a combination of things. It's both research and practical. Research stuff is what we sort of do behind the scenes, looking at fly casting from the physics and the physical aspects of it, including biomechanics and the medical side of it. There's a surprising number of people that either have injuries that affect their fly casting or have actually gotten injuries from casting, playing big fish. Typically it's from casting, blowing out a rotator cuff, getting, you know, casting elbow, that type of thing. It's more prevalent than you might think. That's part of the research side of it. The clinic side of it, the practical side, is actually, hey, incorporating all these cool technologies, including 3D motion capture, Lord of the Rings kind of stuff, with the little reflective balls, infrared cameras, checking out your casting from 3D, all the way to, let's see here, what have we got? Oh, yeah, wireless video goggles so you can watch yourself cast. Casting analyzer, the Perkins Richard casting analyzer, we use one of those, too, to show you some things. Videotape, all that kind of stuff, so that we can analyze your cast and take a good long look at it. And if people have medical problems, injuries, or just need strengthening, we have rehab. We have got all sorts of good stuff that goes on at the clinic. And, of course, fishing on top of it. But, yeah, the FCI is pretty interesting. We're doing some neat research with cutting-edge technology and also doing some things to help people cast healthier, better, and longer.
Okay, and what's the website for that?
That's just flycastinginstitute.com. And if you happen to be poking around at jasonborger.com, I probably have about a zillion links on there back to the FCI as well. So you
Terrific.
Can get to it either way.
Terrific. Well, I'm sure everyone will love to go check that out. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time again, and we need to wrap things up, Jason. But if you'll hang in here with me for a few minutes, I'd appreciate it. And when we return, we'll be giving away that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So stay tuned to see if you win. Okay. The largest and most prestigious fly fishing competition in the United States, the National Fly Fishing Championship, will take place in Colorado during the first week of October. The National Fly Fishing Championship, sponsored by Colorado Trout Unlimited, and the fly fishing industry, involves teams from different regions of the country, Fly Fishing Team USA, and international competitors. The payoff is gold, silver, and bronze medals, and an opportunity to be selected as a member of Team USA, who will represent our country in the 2008 World Championships in New Zealand. Volunteers are needed. Interested parties may apply online at www.nationalflyfishingchampionship.com. That's www.nationalflyfishingchampionship.com. Well, from our global events calendar, we see that on Saturday, October 6th, beginning at 1 p.m., the 2007 Oregon State Steelhead Championship Fly Fishing Challenge will be held near Medford, Oregon, in the Upper Rogue River. An invitation is extended by the Rogue Fly Fishers to enter the 2007 challenge, where the most inches of fish caught and released will win you the title and the trophy of state championship. So if you want to find more out about this, go to our global events calendar on our website, and the link is at the bottom and the top of every page of our site, and just look under the U.S., then Oregon, for more information. Fly shops and clubs, you can list all your fly fishing-related events on our global events calendar. It's free. You can do it yourself. Just go to the events calendar and get started. And get your events out there for everyone to see, both classes, demos, clinics, shows, schools, really anything related to fly fishing. And we highlight one of those events on our calendar on each of our shows like we just did. Okay, before we do our giveaway, I just wanted to, a quick reminder to everybody, to leave, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think about this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate your input. Well, now it's time to give away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And the way we do this is you have to be pre-registered on the site, and it's a little late for that now, but next time make sure you do that for the drawing in advance or during the show so that you're qualified to be a winner. Now, what we do is we just use the magic button here on the computer, and it randomly picks somebody from our database that registered in advance. So the first giveaway I'm going to do tonight is for the Federation of Fly Fishers, a 3-year membership to that, which is always a great gift to receive. And for that, I get a Alan, and it looks like Muratet. Alan Muratet in Colorado. So, Alan, congratulations winning that three-year membership to the Federation. And then Fly Fusion Magazine, a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada, but actually serves both the U.S. and Canada, and a wonderful, colorful magazine. And the winner for that one-year subscription is Michael May. Michael May in Illinois. Terrific. Okay, now, folks, are you ready? This is the question for tonight's $20 gift certificate at Front Range Anglers, and that is, what is, and you're going to type this on the home page, right there on the front page in that text box, put in your name and your location, and what is the name of Jason's book on casting? Think they're going to get this, Jason?
I hope so.
Well, we'll
see. Said viral marketing, you know, just get everybody talking about it. There you go.
Yeah, exactly. So let me check here and see if we have anybody that's responding. Oh, another question. A little late for the question. Can't do that one. A couple more questions. These guys came in too late here. Still waiting for the answer. What's the name of Jason's book? Nobody knows, huh? You better. They're slow typers, Jason.
I know.
Well, like the name of the book is Nature of Fly Casting, so we don't have a winner on that. How about, what cast do you do to do an aerial mend? What's it called? We'll throw that one out there, Jason. They didn't get that one. We're not giving anything away tonight. Oh, here we got, we got one to the book, and this is as close as we got. We got casting a modular approach. Pretty close, huh?
That's at least the last half of it. That gets probably the harder half. So, congratulations, you got the hard half.
Yeah.
Good.
Nature of Fly Casting, a modular approach. So, but he didn't give us her name. Oh, well, that doesn't help. I don't know who wins. Okay, here we go. We got a winner here because he put his name in his location, Alan, Chris, in Glen Rose, Texas.
Alan. Nature of, I know who Alan is. All right.
You know Alan?
I do, as a matter of fact.
Well, he just got a $20 gift certificate. Congratulations, Alan.
All right,
and,
Alan, good for you.
I'm glad you got these. He's probably got your book sitting right there, huh?
I think Alan does. Yeah, I've known Alan for 20 years, so, yeah.
Well, good. I'm glad we got a winner.
He does great stuff with kids, too, I'll tell you. Alan's a good guy.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Jason. We really appreciate you being with us here again tonight. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And
my pleasure to be on the show. I always enjoy it very much.
And like always, we didn't get through all the questions, Jason.
I know. We have to have one of these shows
good.
Last about 6 hours and just go through everything start to finish.
We have a marathon call, right?
I'd do it. I'd be happy to do it sometime.
well, if you'll have us, we'll have you back again, that's for sure. So.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Well, our next broadcast will be on October 3rd at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, and on that show we're going to interview Jason's father, Gary Borden.
Oh, that's right. He is going to be on.
And our topic for the show will be designing trout flies. And Gary Borger literally wrote the book on designing trout flies because he has one by that title. So he knows the subject really well. Gary's background as a biologist provides him with an approach to designing flies that few fly fishers can really claim. So join myself and Gary to find out what makes a successful fly that can catch fish. So we will look forward to having you on that next show. We would like to thank the Platte River Fly Shop, Bristol Bay Alliance, Women's Fly Fishing, Family Ties, and National Fly Fishing Championship for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com. Make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. And feel free to explore the other areas of our site, like events calendar and our directories. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.